doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. That lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. So lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Blue railroad train, good old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go. Get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT, Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. Today is Sunday, January the 5th, 2020. It's the first program of this program for the new year. And this is the Prairie Monk Show. This is our weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, and everything else that's happening in nature and whatever else Dave feels like talking about.
Well, we lost a friend and relative this Christmas. T.J. Jacobs passed on. Many of you won't know T.J. because he left this community about 25 years ago and was in Colorado, but he did his degrees here. He taught in the forestry department here, and he was a consummate environmentalist. He and Nancy left after 2 years here and went to Colorado. This was a very eclectic gentleman. I enjoyed his teaching on the side. His students, some of whom would be rather frustrated because he taught his semester in an experiential way, and then his questions at the end would be more global. And for people who are interested in a textbook and examinations that come with multiple choice, that can be rather frustrating. He knew his territory. He knew his university associates, whether they be in science education or in agriculture or forestry. And he knew the community action, was prepared to communicate, and was on the Science Teachers Association, if I remember rightly. He was here recently. He and Nancy, his associate for 25 years, rode bicycle across the country. And that was quite an achievement. I can remember him saying that he initially didn't have a great deal of regard for little stores like Casey's in a small town, where they replaced small shops that had lost out to transportation and malls and things like that. But Casey's came in, they wanted a liquor license, and they had a different style, so sometimes you could be disappointed about the Casey's sitting outside at the edge of town. But he had a sneaking respect for those sorts of stores as he rode across the country, because they were the only ones that provided food and drink when needed. And they certainly service small communities. He's had many, many jobs, and he enjoyed all the jobs he was in. The one that he had last was insurance assessor. And he was explaining to me how he had worked with the company to get the 6 weeks or whatever it was to be enough to ride across the country. He had a heart problem he didn't know about till just the last couple of weeks, and passed out as a result of that. He had scheduled an operation for January, which is right now. And so he was always able to handle a lot of topics, to add something of his own. And when he was here last, I took him out by 150 and the Kickapoo Trail and up north and then back around. And I was glad he did that. And he's got a base here in Champaign as well as his base in Colorado. And we say farewell to TJ, and we hope that some of you will take on some of the talent that TJ had. He had an influence that will go on to other generations and even further than that. And we hope that some of you will take off in that direction. We've just lately been talking about coming to the university to do studies and applauding the university for allowing independent studies. I came here from Australia, part curiosity, part wanting to do a higher degree, and part looking for the ecosystem. I couldn't find the ecosystem, and it was prairie, and got involved. And I want to run through some of the things we did. We did this last week to some extent, but it's an accumulation. You will understand more. It involves how we get to do these sorts of things that might not be straightforward. When I came, I was wanting to combine biochemistry and art and education, and I thought I was wanting to bridge between research universities and colleges that are more applied. So my interest was not in discovery, but in communication, and especially audiovisual communication. I have an art background in my family, and I feel at home when I'm in places like the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, where I worked for a while. And it's just combining those three a number of years ago was not regarded as very sophisticated. It's more a research university, and a topic would be a special topic in one field, not in several. That has changed a lot, and the university is now more oriented to team work and various disciplines, and we enjoy that. It's not to take place the place of pure studies. That's very essential. But we need some of the other. And in the background of that, there is the willingness of university personnel and departments to not only allow you to do things, but to encourage you to do things. So I want to talk to you as people that are going to do your own thing, perhaps. I go to art showing, and I find the artists are sometimes walking rivers and making statements about environment. So it is happening, and we hope that you as environmentalists with a huge number of fields will feel at home to do that and to ask questions, to figure out whether you want to be in the College of Agriculture, in fine arts, or in engineering. It's not easy, but I want to give you the courage to do that sort of thing. It may mean that if you're coming from Parkland College with a applied background, you might have to go to math and physics and chemistry and fundamental sciences that might be fairly challenging to people who have come in off the street. But there are programs that allow you to do that, not only allow you to do that, but they encourage you to do that. The state, I'm not quite sure of the details, but at the moment the state is looking at providing help for that sort of education, and I won't speak to it at the moment because I don't know the details, but it would seem that we need middle-level people who will, for instance, do repair work. The computer people are lacking the people who fix a dead computer or take apart and make something else out of it. So we're looking to encourage some of you out there who are interested in doing that sort of thing. Sometimes you will be specialists, and we've been talking a little bit about Wolfram, where you have people sitting in a basement with a computer playing games and not quite knowing what to do. They don't really want to belong to a curriculum that has all sorts of demands on it. So it's hard to get that sort of person out of the basement into gaming, or perhaps into some field where they can contribute. And they certainly, we need them. They can contribute in a mighty way because they're very expert. Gates, for instance, did not get a degree in the sense of computer science or artificial intelligence or anything like that. So Wolfram would say, I want to teach teachers how to stimulate those people to get into action and have fun for a lifetime doing the things they want to do. So I read obituaries and other things and often pick up ideas of people who have started things that you wouldn't imagine. Forbes, many, many years ago, put together what ended up as the Natural History Survey, a big organization now, but it had to start somewhere. And so some of you are out there scratching your head as to what to do, might think of doing more general things, and I, scratching my head, will want to explain what I did. Perhaps there will be some elements that you might find useful. And some of those were working through different venues. I started out in agronomy because I had an agriculture degree. And so I learned there the wily ways of extension people. Many of them did not have a PhD. They were very applied people out there in the field teaching people how to fertilize or change their genetics or whatever. And these people were humanists that could go into a community. Associated with that was an agri-visual services, agricultural visual services, controls the like of radio broadcasts that continue to this day. You can't put on WILL without, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, without encountering Todd Leeson doing extension work. There is video, and video requires a certain talent, and agricultural visual services did that. Hadley Reed was in charge and was a specialist in writing for these sorts of things. Another unit that was very helpful was the Office of Instructional Development. There we had people who could watch test and measurement. We worked with the botany department to encourage field work, and you had something like 600 beginning botany students, many of whom were going to go to be school teachers and out into the community without having had any experience with field trips. So we did a small textbook on Brownfield Woods. We created a trail there with the cooperation of the Graduate College Committee on Natural Areas, which supervises university natural areas. So the Office of Instructional Resources was interested in how we might assess the value of this program, not only to the teachers, but to the students themselves. So we would do litter collection and try to do it so that we didn't destroy any research opportunities, because these are small tree, Brownfield Woods and Treeless Woods are small research woods that you can't afford to destroy. So anything you do can't be something that destroys the opportunities. So could you take video and use the video as a testing device after the experience was there? It involves organization, and we have to be tremendously grateful for those people who get their jollies out of organizing people. In the case of 600 students in botany, we would have to have 600 or 700 busloads of people, and the university is, believe it or not, in loco parentis. That means that if little Johnny falls out of a tree and breaks his leg, it might be a university problem. So there's all sorts of things that organizers are very helpful with. They know what the legalities are. They know the timing. They know that not everyone gets up at 8 o'clock in the morning or even before that. So you time your field trip. And there has to be a relationship to Dr. Kendi, who was in charge of Committee on Natural Areas, and Dr. Getz after that. And these are people who know their areas, who know where the birds are, and they have worked hard to to preserve these places and to connect them. It's called connectivity, and it's an attempt to have areas that are not just 60 acres here but 60 acres there, but also the corridor between. So they've got Phillips Tract between Brownfield and Treeless Woods. In an era when there was getting to be none of this sort of stuff left. If you're looking for a 400-year-old tree, it's probably been harvested for wood. Settlers came in and forests were much more in their line of thinking. And so they were there in the forests utilizing the lumber. And so we don't have much of this sort of stuff left. In amongst that whole thing was a curriculum lab. The curriculum lab handles university high school, and we almost lost the university high school. Some strong parents eventually saved it, so it's still sitting there today. But these sorts of organizations don't always get the credit that it leaves them space to survive. And the curriculum lab gave us space and the opportunity. I'd been working with an organization called the School Science Curriculum Project, and that was developing small units of physics or chemistry or biology that could go into a school classroom without overwhelming the teacher. They would be given to the teacher, so the teacher becomes the person that not only knows the students but knows the unit. And I made an example of a unit on running water and river development so that you could see how the river runs and a little device that goes with it. Well, they had a leg into the curriculum lab also. And behind the curriculum lab, there was Plato, Netscape, and those programs were being developed and moved along, and Plato was there. And the young students would check Plato out in the era when they had an orange-colored display. I'm not sure why it was orange, but it was had something to do with the type of screen. And if you wanted a visual, you had to have a carousel on top of the booth and pull it in at the time. Bitsu was there working with trying to get a narrow screen, which eventually became national or worldwide. The curriculum lab not only allowed or helped, but really was excited to encourage. So we had an organization called the Natural Areas Instructional Development, and that worked with departments. Sometimes I might be brought in as a devil's advocate to sit in a classroom and ask rude questions that might stimulate some student back answer. Or it might be a slide, or it might be a series of slides. It might be a display, or just being there, like T.J. Jacobs. If he was there, he was there as a resource. We worked at this for quite some time. There was a little bit of feeling that we were working in the community, which we were. That's part of the role of extension, is to go out in the community. And this does not look like fundamental research. So where did you belong? Do you belong in science education, or do you belong in extension, not agricultural extension? That's a possibility too. If you are young and trying to do some of these things and you have a rough idea of what your goals are, then you need to have the gall to be able to ask. And surprisingly, if you ask, interesting things will happen, and you will tie into things that you never dreamed of thinking about. So that's the value of a university. You'll never have it again if you have it here for 3 or 4 years. Work at it and express yourself, be yourself. Don't necessarily feel that you have to belong to someone else. Sometimes that's a good idea, because that someone else might be doing exactly what you want to do, and you can tie on to a part of it. So there's all sorts of ways of doing things here, and the university is very good at doing that. Yeah, this is still a reasonably conservative university that does things in a straightforward manner. If you go to other institutions, you might find it more liberal. If you're in Berkeley or at University of Michigan or Minnesota, you're going to get a different attitude. If you go to Duke in Carolina, you're going to get a colleagist. Just move yourself around. Well, we had the opportunity to do this. We've given space, and we produced artwork that was quality artwork. It could stand with other artists, with high contrast silkscreen printing, interpreting the landscape. And some of those prints are still around. It involved people. If you go and do silkscreen printing, you needed about 5 people on the team, and they all shout at each other and enjoy each other's company and get things done. They actually see prints coming out, and then they see prints being sold, because people want to not only support you, but they like the damn art. So it's around, and sometimes people retire and leave prints on my doorstep because they can't take them to their retirement village, but they have had them for many years. We developed these sorts of teaching programs. We taught in outdoor education, in recreation. It was a new field. It was a field which was somewhat applied to park districts and physical education, and it often got the criticism of being a very applied sports-oriented organization. At the other end of it, it had people who were doing studies of physiology and muscle electronics or whatever. Nugent was in there with wheelchair people. But we taught outdoor education for quite a while. Often we were asked if we would want to become specialists in that field. And my feeling there was that the specialists that do this should be in the field. So we found Larry Kamen in botany, and he became a specialist in curriculum development, and it had the character of botany to come with it. So that was interesting and helpful. We gradually got to the point where we were servicing a lot of different departments and on a revolving account. That's not awfully permanent, because a revolving account means that you're dependent on departments having money, which is called contingency money, which lets you do some of these things. And as things get tight, then the contingency money is not there. But we survived with the help of Curriculum Lab, and we did some teaching with the University High School. And we work with Curriculum Lab people, Dr. Beeman, Bill Golden, and others, Smock in Office of Instructional Resources, Kendi in Natural Areas. We were basically concerned that prairie was a gene pool that was almost extinct. It's here in little pieces. It's mainly on railroad lines that by happenstance had a law that meant that farmers couldn't invade the very good soil on the edge of the railroad line. They sometimes did, and they still sometimes do. But we needed an advocacy for the prairie, and then we had quite a deal of debate about whether this should be involving specialists who already knew about prairie, you know, or knew how to organize, or whether it should be allowed to do its own thing, or encouraged to do its own thing, or so. Eventually, after quite some time, we ran a prairie conference at Mahomet. And that was an interesting experience. We hadn't had that sort of community involvement. It's a school that has a gymnasium there, but it also has an auditorium, which is big enough to have the community involved rather than only just the school, and it closes at 5 o'clock, and that item is not used. Park districts and schools now get together and have a cooperative swimming pool, for instance. And that was happening. We did field trips, and shortly after that, we encouraged the putting together of a group of people. First of all, they needed some land acquisition. Where was the prairie we were going to teach from? We can reconstruct prairies. They're a poor facsimile of what you might get from a planted prairie like Meadowbrook. The reconstruction prairies are quite useful. They look like a prairie, but they don't have 100 species, and they don't have thousands and millions of bacteria in the soil and the like. And most all of Illinois has been moved into agriculture or other domains. The state has managed to preserve formerly 0.01% of the prairie that was here. It was 2/3 of the state was prairie. 90% of some of these counties was prairie. So, but it's not an attractive ecosystem. It doesn't compare with trees. So often we find that trees are being planted on prairie soils, but it's because they're attractive. Prairies just look like weeds, and they've been used as weeds for six generations. People have been trying to turn that sod under and put in first livestock and then row crops. So we've walked probably hundreds of miles looking for prairie that might be useful. It had to be somewhere close to institutions, or you could never take people to it. So we found a little piece of prairie at Gifford that was reasonably intact, and that became the first item on a organization which eventually became called Grand Prairie Friends. It was indeed an the mission was advocacy for prairie. There's a lot of organizations that work with forests, and very few work with prairie. It's gotten better. It's better in the Chicago area. There are hundreds of little prairies around, but capturing prairies is up to the State Department of Natural Areas and Illinois Nature Preserves Commission. But if you're a student, you're watching these things. You like T.J. Jacobs, you know about them. You can go and say, hey, there's a 30-mile of railroad bed we worked 3 or 4 years to preserve, and then the Department of Natural Resources saved it by buying it, but did it so slowly that 11 sites were not available. They were already bought by adjacent farmers. So last year that line was turned back to agriculture, which took out a large portion of our only remaining prairie. I don't care if we lost the recreational opportunity, but we have a gene pool responsibility. So if we don't do these things, we're in jeopardy of losing the last little pieces we have. So eventually the Grand Prairie Friends did do a lot of work with Loder, a cemetery prairie. They did very well. They put their own group together. They got together at Lois Drury's and Katie Hammerick's, were two Audubon people who really wanted this to happen. So they offered their house as a meeting place, and Grand Prairie Friends put themselves together there. I think about 8 people, and off they went. And over a 35-year period, they have done very well. They have morphed off into the forest some, mainly because there's a good opportunity there, and that doesn't hurt at all. That allows them to become a trust. It allows them to have over 1,000 acres of forest and prairie, mostly prairie that has been cornfield, and it's going back to prairie. So it's not remnant prairie, but it's creating the atmosphere. And they have organizers who can do the audiovisual thing. They put out a brochure at the time of annual presentation that is very good. It has some of the elements of advertising design. It brings together a lot of people. And on an open house, when they want to plant trees, they can get over 100 volunteers in the Cole County area. They have representatives on this Prairie State Conservation Coalition. And so then the state looks at things like stewardship and how the state might encourage stewardship. It works with trusts that have been established, the Nature Conservancy, a number of trusts that encourage by giving funds, Clean Energy Foundation, the Lumpkin Foundation, do this. We found and worked with and managed for quite some time a shady rest at behind White Heath, and that became part of what we find possible to put into a Piatt County Forest Preserve, so it's in perpetuity. And that's the sort of thing that Grand Prairie Friends has been doing. I have to say that in all these things, you need some feedback. If we're talking to the University of Illinois Board of Trustees, we have to balance our interests in extension with a university that's oriented to economy. If you go down First Street, you'll see all sorts of businesses that have been attracted in to have one leg in business and one leg in the university. If you're going to do that sort of thing, then you have to be there to support the Natural History Survey, which is now within the university framework, and we have to wonder how it gets funded in competition with economy. So when you're dealing with a major institution, and it may be more than that, it may be national institution, it may be, if it's climate, it's international institutions. It's people trying to research how to work with fire in Africa or Australia or other places. But you need some feedback, and I want to remind those people who are doing this sort of work, and you, if I'm talking to students, finding your way through, you spending 2, 3, 4, 5 years at this, and how do you work your way through it? So I want to encourage you to do it, but I want you to, when you do successful things, to give some feedback to the institution, to let the Office of Instructional Resources, the Curriculum Lab, the Nature Preserves Commission, Commission on Natural Areas, the departments, life sciences and the like, you need to encourage that in the background so that you do, over the years, not lose something like 30 mile of railroad bed that is good prairie. It also means that you have to represent yourself in voter behavior too. So we need to be able to do that. In order to do that, you have to be out there giving some recognition to the people behind the scenes, and that's one of my messages right now. Right now, we're looking at 33 miles of a different railroad bed. We created a Heartland Pathways, and its mission was to buy railroad bed when it was being abandoned. And it is for rails, trails, and greenways. So a lot of our background work before we bought, or even shortly after we bought, was, do we need to keep this so that grain companies can move freight from one place to another? We eventually established that they didn't need that. Cisco Grain could take grain out to Decatur one way. If they have two ways to go, if they could take it out across the Sangamon River to Monticello and down to Bemmermund, and where the headquarters of Top Flight Grain is, then you have two outlets. You have one at Decatur and another one on the Wabash Railroad. So connectivity in the railroad business is important. So one of the reasons why we bought rails, trails, and greenways was for rails. And we haven't had to do that very much, but we are going from Whiteheath to Seymour, re-railing 4 miles of abandoned rail bed, so that we hope to get a contiguous railroad museum historic trains into Champaign. Now that might not look like prairie, but it's engineering. It's trying to get people together in different dimensions. And how do we do it? If you are dependent on two elevators that are selling grain and they don't have a weighbridge, then you're going to have to buy a railroad weighbridge, not a road one. That's grain comes in and you put the grain into the elevator. I'm talking about if you sell grain to Alabama, to a chicken farmer, then the chicken farmer doesn't have a way of weighing the grain. And if we don't have a way of doing that, then you have to think about that. Or you have to rent a railroad bridge. So 3 miles at least of track is being abandoned nearby, contiguous. So we're working with the Surface Transportation Board in Washington that controls our Rail Banking Act. We did this sort of thing before there was a Rail Banking Act. We did for rails, trails, and greenways. Well, more recently, there's been a Rail Banking Act, which is administrated mainly to preserve the dignity of railbeds. And that is behind the Kickapoo Trail, which got $12 million to be developed as a rail trail and can go back to railroad if necessary. Then there are trails, and the trails are recreation. So then you have to go back to the people who wanted to preserve things in the first place. You go to George Fell, who was the nature conservant founder and went to Washington for about 7 years and came back to the Illinois, and he created a forest preserve, and people in political situations wanted it to include recreation. So the forest preserve lost a little of the preservation side of things. So here you are balancing recreation against preservation. So George created a Vermilion County Conservation District. So its conservation districts are much more able to maintain the prairie on either side of their balance, whereas rail trails are often very wide. So if you have a chance to develop a trail, you have to have this sort of debate. What is the balance between rail and trail? If you go rail, trail, and greenways. So our segment of railroad bed between Monticello and Cisco is 2 miles of wonderful rail trail that's been put in by the city of Monticello. Goes over the Sangamon. You can stop there and look at the Sangamon, and you can. It's got ambience, and it's got connectivity to Allerton Park, and it could be extended by 4 miles to Armenia and then to Cisco, and from Cisco into Decatur is no longer possible to have a trail on the rail bed because it's used as a grain line. So recently we've had some discussion about putting in a trail, but my fear at the moment is that it might be so wide that it takes out a lot of the vegetation on either side, and that has happened in Urbana to St. Joe. much of the edge of the ballast on either side has been included for road widening. Most of the roads went parallel to the railroad line. That was convenient. And so sometimes it's road widening. Sometimes it's just sculpting the landscape so that you then put it back afterwards, whereas I would prefer to have high hose that just skim the 4 inches that you need rather than digging it up and sculpting it back with disturbed soil. So if you're a student and you get involved in these things, there are things that happen that allow you to get involved. Some of the people involved with Students for Environmental Concern with the YMCA are now going to schools for fire training. Early on, fire people, especially in natural areas, didn't get a lot of training. They did it by the seat of their pants. Now you can go to schools and get a certificate for burning a forest or burning a prairie, which is tremendously important. You see what's happening in Australia and California. You are having huge fires which burn like a bonfire, and they sterilize the soil underneath. Whereas if you have a scudsy fire more frequently, then the trees, especially Australian eucalypts, have adventitious buds, and they come back with green in a very short time. So you have trails, and then there's greenways, and the greenways are an important thing for us. It might not be for you. I'm just using this as an example of what you might do as a student who comes and doesn't necessarily want to be highly specialized. Although some people would say we're specialized because we're concerned with prairie. But you have to have these people, and if you get bitten by the bug, then that might be very good. You end up with a job somewhere doing this sort of thing. The Kickapoo Trail, for instance, is very wonderful. It's got glaciation. Glaciation came and filled up the valleys and waterways with interesting rubble from the Laurentian Shield in Canada. But before that, there was tectonics in the Danville area that created blocked drainage where you had Carboniferous era vegetation accumulated with pressure on it. So you have coal. So when you go to Vermilion County, you have to know that you needed coal miners. So then when you do get coal and get electricity and get other jobs, they're often industrial jobs. So Danville is a more industrial town. The University of Illinois is a more academic town. Other places are ethnic. Paxton, where we've been working with a high school, is a Scandinavian town. If you go to Ivesdale, you're dealing with Irish. And these communities are a little bit like a tossed salad. The tomato is still tomato, and lettuce is still lettuce. And there's intermarriage and intertwining. But basically, these communities have that sort of character. Can you find out about it? Can you look at the rural sociology? Can you go to Gilman and talk to Augie Keitzman and find out what it was like to be a welder in World War II? Or where's the Beckman and Butterworth trails? How did people get across the Iroquois River? So just generally, I'm encouraging you out there to get involved. And it doesn't mind if you are a retiree also, because these days, if you retire at the ripe old age of 58, then you've got to stay around for 30 years, and you can do interesting things. And sometimes people in retirement are much busier in their interest because they've got an interest. It's exciting. It might be music, or it might be rainfall, it might be tornadoes, it might be railroads. But you have people who by that time are educated and interested and excited, and they're the ones that move and shake things. Not always easy. You have to stand up in front of a city meeting, or you have to be in a situation where people aren't thinking the same way as you. And so how do you handle that? Over and over, I'm encouraging you to look around while you're at this wonderful university with all its equipment and facilities and people, and find out where you fit. That takes a little bit of get up and go. You can't sit and hope that it'll come to you. You have to be out there talking to this professor, listening to other students. Most of the recommendations you get are from word of mouth. The big courses that work, like T.J. Jacobs, had he had a lot of students because the word got around. And so working, going to a dance, going to music, going to the city meeting, traveling to Chicago and thinking about passenger rail versus freight trains. We want you to think more broadly and not necessarily about what we do, but what we do is often involved because we create skeletons that other people can pick up on. And sometimes we do it more silently than we should do, but often we like to be an inspiration and hand that on to other organizations like the Grand Prix Friends or a docent group, which is a natural area study group. It's also been going for 30 years, and they're docents, so they go to natural areas, educate themselves about that natural area, and then transmit that information to schools and parks. And so I'm encouraging environmental people, because this is not necessarily a big environmental school. It's the common term for it is that it's a hard science school. But I am very pleased to see that the last LAS manual that goes out to LAS people who have been to school there. And the front page is Treeley's Woods, with students measuring the, documenting the woods. And this has been done since Vestal was there years and years ago. The Forestry Department figured that there were about 13 different tree types in Brownfield Woods. So students were documented, and they can do it in a more sophisticated fashion because you have computers and you can put more information in and then be able to retrieve it. Then in not only on the front page, but in there's an article inside on that does more for biology, which sometimes gets to be a poor country cousin. And this is Monk speaking, and it's his opinion, but there's some truth in what I say.
1 minute.
Okay, thank you for listening, folks. Give a call if you have any outrageous things to say about this sort of thing. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It is just seconds before noon. You're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and we are community radio for East Central Illinois. It's time now for Shruti, Music of India. Thank you.